track, session number 30285.
And it's a real footing.
Yeah. So Witten was a really frontline operational reconnaissance station. That was particularly interesting because I was stationed, my post was on the intelligence staff in the operations center on the station. Again, concerned primarily with briefings and tasking the aircraft on their sorties. But the interesting thing there was that these were actually live operational missions. The Canberras would fly operationally up through the Baltic towards Russia and fly parallel courses off the Russian coast, and would then intercept the Russian radars and things like that to ascertain frequencies and operational efficiencies and heights and that sort of information, which they would then bring back and be used, of course, operationally. The Victors belonged to the radar reconnaissance flight. They were tasked to fly to Russia and observe the effects of the strategic missile bombings, if any. So it was a really genuine frontline operation station. I'd already known a number of the people that were there. The wing commander who was the CEO of the radar recce flight, I'd known 10 or 15 years earlier. I didn't do too badly there. We were talking about the escape innovation, and again that was one of my responsibilities, to brief the crews on the problems of escape innovation, but this time not so much from the point of view of being up in mountains, what to do there, or in similar type terrain, but this time what happens if they get captured? How do they deal with this, the methods of interrogation, and how would they react? The Russians, of course, had been practicing interrogation in live terms for many years, and they developed their own tactics for getting information.
What would they have been, and how much knowledge did you have of that, obviously, in your role?
I had quite a great deal of information about the Russian methods of interrogation and what to expect. Strange enough, the Russians didn't use physical violence very much in their interrogation. They had discovered that it's only a matter of time before a man will break. There's a limit to what he can put up with, and if you keep him awake most of the time and don't give him anything and make him sit on uncomfortable things for several hours, strange things happen. But I was I'd already been on the Army Escape and Evasion course at Ashford, and was briefed there by he was then a major, he's now a general, who had been captured in Korea, and had in fact experienced quite a bit of the communist doctrines of interrogation.
Was that Anthony Farrow Hockley?
That's right. He was then a major, and he would lecture to us on what they did to him. And then by coincidence, there was a major escape and evasion exercise set up involving Bomber Command and some of the crews from Witten were detailed to go. So I thought, I'd better go up there with them and indulge myself on the course as well. I think we went up to Dish first. And what they did there, they took us out at night and dropped us, and then said, well, you've got to get to B from here. How you get there, that's up to you. there will be army troops looking for you. And then if you're captured, you'll find out what they do. So I, not being in a crew, I decided to do it on my own. And after having fallen over some of the dry walls that they have up in Yorkshire, and pulled the heel off my flying boot, I thought, this isn't any fun. And so I thought later on in the night that I went and I saw the building. I thought, I'll go over there and have a rest. So I walked over the building, went inside and had a rest. And lo and behold, there were some other chaps in there having a rest as well. And then the next one we were in there, the doors are open and we're all taken prisoner by the army. So we're shuffled out and then the ill treatment starts. And we're taken to, I think it was some sort of farmhouse, something like that, out on the moors, where the interrogation team, the interrogation team that they had there were in fact the team of interrogators who would be used in normal operational circumstances. These weren't, they were the best. And of course they would be there to try and find out exactly what you were doing, where you'd come from, what aircraft you were in, what squadrons were you from, and all that sort of typical type thing. So they captured us, and then they blindfolded us, and I think they made us take our clothes off. Then they made us lean against the wall with our arms outstretched for a long time, and with these sacks over our heads, because you tend to partially asphyxiate yourself, and your mind begins to wander a bit when you're gulping for air. And then, having sort of set us out on that thing, they would then ensure them shouting at people in the background, things like, "Don't move! Stand there!" And all that sort of thing. And I heard a voice from somewhere outside saying, "I want to see a doctor." And you could see that things were quite serious, really. Then they took me for interrogation, and I was the first chap. Yes, he sat me down on a stool, and he abused me. He said, "I wouldn't talk," and he said something like, "You're a disgrace to the officer branch. Look at you." Okay. And you tell me, "You're obviously an officer, and look at you." And he humiliated me. But he didn't get any response from me, not a bit of response. And so they threw me out of there after a time. And then back again, and they put me in a field in the cold and rain, behind some barbed wire. And then eventually they came and fetched me out of there. And there was this time it was a nice chap that spoke to me. He said, "You look as if you could do with a cup of tea." And I didn't answer. He said, "It's all right." He said, "You have a cup of tea." And I thought, I would like a cup of tea. And then I made the mistake of saying, "Yes, I'll have the tea." And that, of course, was just the first part of trying to get me to speak. Because the next thing he said, do you want milk? And I realized the penny dropped very quickly. This was the opening of the conversation. So I didn't take the tea. he came to a halt as well shortly afterwards. But that's one of the tactics they use, as you know. On one hand, they've got someone who's really brutalizing you, trying to, and another, a very charming man who's saying, "This is a very difficult situation for you, and we're trying to help you, and anything we can do," that approach, which is rather, when you're feeling not too good, is a rather nice approach. and that can crack some people. And then there were more interviews to come. And as the hours went and days went by, for that couple of days, you begin to lose, of course, sense of time. You're hungry and thirsty all the time. And I began to see, this was a very, very, very serious interrogation exercise. Eventually, I was called for another interview, and he sat me down and he said, "You can talk now," he said, "because the exercise is over." So I didn't believe him. So I just sat there and I wouldn't speak to him. and then he eventually convinced me that it is over, really. He said, "And I'll tell you something," he said, "we've no idea what you're doing here." He said, "because we don't think you're with a crew." And he said, "the only thing we can think is that you're in an intelligence officer." eventually we sorted ourselves out and got away. In fact, when I was leaving the station, I got my car and left the mess. And I hadn't gone a couple of hundred yards down the road before I almost fell asleep at the wheel. So I hurriedly pulled on the side there of the road, and I spent hours having a sleep before. But the moral of all that, of course, was quite serious, really. It showed the problems of how long you can stand up to interrogation techniques. It's not very long, really, because once you've been denied sleep for any length of time, things happen. And you add that to various other factors, like you want to drink and you're tired and those factors, and you don't generally withstand interrogation for too long.
It's very interesting because obviously you were at that time, we were involved in the height of the Cold War, and obviously these days people find it quite difficult to actually understand what the Cold War was if they didn't experience it. But it seems to me that you took... specifically with the squadrons that you were with and exercises like that, that the threat was taken very, very seriously at that time. Is that right?
It was indeed. And very serious indeed. And on the operations, when we had a walk-in safe arrangement on double combination settings, where all the operational targets, and we would have the crews down and brief them on the target material that we held on the target they've been allocated in the event of war. So you're quite right. This was not a Boy Scout affair. Very serious affair, which we anticipated could result in difficult situations for some people. One of the crews, I'm told, and this is hearsay, but I think it's true, under interrogation gave the people his target, wartime target, and what he had to do, and what else did he give them? The squadron, yes. The squadron and the aircraft he was flying, and where he was told. Now this was under this form of interrogation, and I was told he ran into a lot of trouble. Now, because of that, the other thing of interest was, so far as I know, that was the last exercise of its type because of the outcome of the real hard interrogation. I don't think they held another one of that type again. I wasn't aware of any.
With the operational side of things, you said obviously that the PR squadrons would fly in parallel with the Russian coast. For that, were there occasions at that stage of the war that overflights would occur over Warsaw Pact territory?
No,
it would never happen at all.
No, we didn't do that. An interesting thing, again, during the Cold War period, was that we had a Canberra squadron, my wartime squadron, and my post-war squadron were actually located there by just some extraordinary piece of luck, 59 squadron. They were flying in Canberra. I think they were flying B-8s. But they had... we had an atomic capability. And we had a couple of American officers there who were involved in the question of the use of atomic weapons and fixing and so on like that. And they exercised lab bombing techniques from Great Island Curtain with a squadron. And that that was like home to me, because I would go over to the squadron and they accepted me as a squadron member, and I got on very well with them. In fact, I did a couple of flights with them. We went down to the bombing ranges down at El Adam in Tripoli from Gynekirchen, and that's where we used to do our labs, bombing techniques and so on. So I left 59 Squadron there. They were still active when I left.
Is that the technique of almost? Is it almost like throwing the bomb?
Yes. You pull in, you pull away and release the bomb and pull away from the effects of it and come off the top of the pump when the bomb is going that way, so you can get as far away as possible from the outfall from the bomb. That was one of the incidents at my little affair with the interrogators. And then a rather strange thing happened. I also did a rather nice trip in the PR3s, which are photo reconnaissance cameras. We were sent down to Rhodesia, as we then knew it, to take a series of photographic exercise material. And so that was a flight down to Rhodesia, where we landed and did our task and photographed the items that we were asked to do for the Rhodesian government, and then came back to Witten. And that we flew down at 60,000 feet, which for a coastal command chap who's used to looking at the seabirds and things and the sea, it was a bit on the high side, but it wasn't any problem, of course. So that was a good flight.
What was the camper like to fly in?
Very nice, efficient aircraft. Yes, no problem. No problem. And a first-class operation design. Excellent aircraft, really, for its purpose and its timing. Good enough for the Americans to take it over. As you know, I think they called it the B-57 or something like that. But a wonderful aircraft. And yes, carried out an operational role without any problem. And, of course, now I come to think of it, they were used in the Suez campaign. I knew the CO of 10 Squadron. And when I took those maps I mentioned to you down to Cyprus, I met him in the mess. And unlike the wartime mess atmosphere, it was pretty somber, I thought. And he said to me, what are they saying about all this at home? They'd just completed the first bomber attacks on the bases in Egypt. And I had to tell him that some of the British papers were strongly against what we were doing. And he said, yeah, that's what we thought. So morale was none too high at all, none too high. And of course, one of the Canberras, I think it was a 10 Squadron Canberra, he pulled the undercarriage when he was taken off on the sortie around the Perry Track. And that was a reflection of the uncertainty of those chaps they had to put up with when everything was all very wrong somewhere. Yeah. The CO had been out with me when I was a trainee, so I'd known him for a few years. Yes. So the time came, unfortunately, when I had to leave. Witten.
When was that? When would that be?
That would have been 59, 61. Yes. Because the other aspect of it was that JARIC, that's the Joint Air Reconnaissance Intelligence Centre, was located at Bramwell, just outside Huntingdon. So the whole of the reconnaissance empire was located on the airfield at Witten, and in the Joint Air Reconnaissance who would give us the targets that, and briefings that were needed for the various types of things. So it was a fulfilling job. It was a live job, and that was that. So then it came at posting time, and lo and behold, they sent me to RAF Bridgnorth. Bridgnorth, as you probably know, is in Shropshire, on the Severn, or quite close to it. And this was the recruits training station where the National Service had stopped by that time. So the station was concerned solely with volunteers. And then I found myself with a squadron of three flights and two young, very young officers as flight commanders, whilst we trained these recruits into Ireland before sending them off on whatever role they were going to do in the RAF for their training and so on like that.
So was it just a basic training station?
Just basic, yes. The usual things, drills, discipline, and the basics of service procedures and response, lectures about this, that, and various other things. But basically, we had them out on the parade grounds and so on. And then, when the flights were trained up and had met the requirements of the period that we had them, I took them on the parade ground. With rifles and bayonets to finish off their training.
With something like this, is it the kind of RAF policy to give you different examples of the kind of RAF structure? So they send you to this kind of training after you've had a live posting, that type of thing. Do they tend to do that?
Yes. But people tend to find themselves becoming specialists in some form. I seem to be in the intelligence world, but it'll be noticeable later on. But at that time, having come from two operational stations and an operational place at the ministry on the targeting side, it was rather strange for me to find myself on a training station, which in technical training command, which I'd never been in since I don't know. About 1941 or something, whenever we did our training, I suppose. And that's it. That, so it was all seemed very strange to me. The station itself wasn't very good. It was pretty well run down. It was tatty. Wooden huts that had been in use since the 40s beginning to show signs of age and falling down, things like that. And I did express that, I think, and I became very unpopular on the station. I made the mistake of pointing out to the station commander, I was very surprised to see the state of the showers for the army. I didn't go down very well. Fortunately, they were ripping out all the showers and wash basin things and rebuilding them when the instruction came through the station was closing. So, with a sigh of relief, I was posted. I don't think I won any medals there or anything like that.
How long had you been there at Bridgnorth?
I think it was about 6 months. Something like that. I didn't get any flying or anything like that. I remember being invited down to Bridgnorth to give a talk one evening, but that wasn't remember. So anyway, that was a very brief thing. And my next posting was much more interesting. We're now coming up to Christmas, when that appalling winter in the 60s,
63.
One of the worst since the war, it's 63, and that was a nightmare. And so I had to get from Bridgnorth down to High Wycombe to the headquarters, And I gave them a phone call to say the conditions up there were pretty bad, and snow everywhere. Perhaps I could stay around a bit until it quieted down, but they said, no, you get down here. So I found myself down at Bomber Command, as it then was. And that was an extremely interesting job in a way. Strangely enough, I was working with a squadron leader there who'd been my squadron leader at Witten. That was remarkable, I suppose. So we had our responsibilities there. I think mine was a little more obscure. I had the responsibility for keeping an eye on the Russian naval aircraft and any attacks that could have come from the north there. And again, with the business of disseminating relevant information to relevant people, keeping the air staff and the CNC and so on advised of any changes that were taking place of significance.
How much threat would this kind of Soviet naval aircraft present, really, at that time?
It was a question of the aircraft that they have, and from their naval bases. They had some quite advanced aircraft at the time. I can't remember the names of them now. They were the type of aircraft that we thought might be appearing off our coast and down in the North Atlantic, North Sea, and things like that. No, not the four-engine strategic ones, but the other ones. But they were quite modern aircraft, so that was one of the elements I had to keep an eye on. And for that matter, from time to time, I'd write a paper about changes that were taking place or something like that.
What would be your kind of sources of intelligence? Where would you get that material from? Your updates, that sort of thing?
Well, mostly of all of it, actually, the Ministry of Defence, where we had a direct line.
So they would gather it from a number of sources and then disseminate it down to yourself too?
That's right. Yeah. We had a direct line, classified, with the ministry, and stuff would pop down there quite quickly. And we could have it in the hands of people concerned very quickly after we'd evaluated it. And we gave talks to visiting people who'd come up to the headquarters, maybe MPs and some of the ministry. And we'd give them what the position was within the command. Because we were there, and I was there during the unfortunate time with the Valiants, if you remember, having failed the air test, we were all grounded. So we lost those ones that I was there. And what